Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome again to the Explaining History podcast, and today I'm going to talk about the years 1933 to 34 in Spain, when the newly formed government from the November 1933 election indicated a huge shift towards the political right. And along with this came a wave of violence against the left, against the trade union organisations of Spain, and particularly against attempts by the peasants to politically organise themselves. In what was still a largely agrarian economy, the threat of an organised peasant polity, an organised peasant population, presented a terrifying challenge to the power of landowners. As I've discussed in this podcast before, when it comes to Spain and the eve of the Spanish Civil War, the combined power of landowners, army officers, and the Catholic Church was the nexus of reaction in Spain. But it was the landowners who held basically most of the economic power, the financial power, behind the parties of the new right. So today we're going to be looking at Paul Preston's amazing book, The Spanish Holocaust, which is his history of the Spanish Civil War, and really it is a history from the point of genocide studies, the study of mass killing. Paul Preston writes, "In the wake of their electoral victory in November 1933, the right went on to the offensive just as the unemployment crisis reached its peak. That December, there were 619,000 out of work across Spain, 12% of the total workforce. Given Spain's lack of social welfare schemes, these figures, although much lower than those in Germany and Italy, signified widespread and immense physical hardship. With the socialist leader Francisco Largo Cabrallo no longer at the Ministry of Labour, there was no protection even for those in work. In Jaén, for instance, the new radical civil governor set aside existing agreements on working conditions. In the case of the turno rigoroso, the strict rotation of work amongst unemployed labourers during the olive harvest, the owners were left free to give work only to the cheapest non-union labour. The consequence was large numbers of families on the verge of starvation." So, during the Great Depression, the triumph of right-wing parties in 1933 meant a huge transition away from social democratic politics and back towards aggregations of power in the hands of the landowning classes. This had catastrophic consequences for Spain's poor. As Preston points out, there's no social security net in Spain whatsoever. If you think about the hardships experienced in Britain, in Germany, in France during the Great Depression, even in America, these are countries who have some degree of social security provision during this time. There is nothing in Spain. The way in which the Spanish poor had traditionally survived was through tacit and unspoken agreements and social compacts with the landowners, where the landowners would, in some instances, hopefully see that they had social obligations, and in return they would have a relatively pliant workforce. By 1933, the landowners saw things in fundamentally different ways. Due to the political upheavals of the 1920s in Spain, they tended to view their approach towards the peasants as one of open class warfare. The peasants were dangerous, ungrateful, and in some cases they sort of othered them to the extent that they didn't even see them as being Spanish. There was a belief that the dark, dirty-looking peasants were Moorish. And so there was all sorts of kind of racial prejudice mixed up in their treatment towards the Spanish, even the Spanish peasantry, even though the Spanish peasantry were probably as Spanish as the landowners were. And there is a great deal of anti-Semitism amongst the Spanish landowners as well. The irony being that the last Jews left Spain in the 15th century, forced out by King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella. The belief was that the prevalence of socialist ideas was evidence that the Jews were somehow creeping back into Spain. And it shows you that anti-Semitism is something that can exist in a country even when there are no Jewish people present. The terno rigoroso, the policy of rotating the work available between unemployed workers, unemployed peasants, was something that was often seen as a kind of a concession from the landlords to the poor, not very much of one, admittedly, an attempt to be fair. But now landlords were desperate to simply find the cheapest workforce available. The fact that right-wing landowning supporting parties had won a huge victory in the election of November 1933 emboldened them. The largest party in the Spanish government was SIDA, led by Gil Robles. SIDA, the Confederación Española de Tejeras Autónomas, or the Spanish Confederation of Autonomous Rights, was a political party that really represented the Catholic conservative elements of society. Mainly it was a party that was interested in preserving the rights of landowners, but it had all sorts of drifting sentiments towards more fascist thought. The idea that it was there to defend Christian civilization, and that as with Nazism, as with Italian fascism, there's this idea that some kind of official, historically sanctified version of civilization was under threat from mysterious and dangerous forces. It was there to protect religion and family property, and Robles himself said that he intended to give Spain a true unity, a new spirit, a totalitarian polity, of which he said, "Democracy is not an end, but a means to the conquest of the new state. When the time comes, either Parliament submits or we will eliminate it." Robles, like the other members of the Spanish far-right, drifting from extreme conservative views through to fascist ideas, was obsessed with Marxism. He believed that Marxism was a Jewish conspiracy, a Jewish threat, and was part of a worldwide Judeo-Bolshevik threat, that somehow the Russian Revolution had infiltrated Spain and the Jews were in some way involved. And there were countless Catholic writers, many of them priests at the time, who fed into these conspiracy theories in sort of newspaper articles and pamphlets and letters. So there was a whole culture of anti-socialist thinking that chimed with the interests of the Catholic Church, And it presented to the landowners, to the army, to the Catholic Church, to some of the middle classes, a clear narrative about what was going on. In essence, that a battle for Spain's soul was underway, that either the Marxists would succeed and stamp out centuries of Catholic civilization, and they would be in some way in allegiance with dangerous foreign elements, or that holy Catholic royal Spain would once again come together and triumph, as it had done during the Middle Ages against the Moors, and that Spanish national identity and national unity would be enhanced as a result, with a strong leader anointed and given the blessing of the Catholic Church, leading Spain back to its traditional hierarchical, stratified and feudal way of operating. In some of the sort of iterations of fascism that you see throughout the 1930s, there is a mixture of looking back to the past, looking back to past glories. That's what, you know, fascism has all of these things within it, fused with a kind of a version of modernism, an idea that the reclaimed glories, along with modern technology of the radio and the propeller engine and all these other kind of useful bits and bobs, would propel the nation into the glorious future. But one simply had to remember the noble sacrifices of the past. There's none of that sort of theme of modernity, really, in this view of Spanish fascism. Just a simply an attempt to reclaim the past and bring it into the present, and actually sweep away modernity in terms of kind of a social democratic modernity that might possibly emerge in the guise of an educated, well-fed, electorally educated peasantry and workforce. Paul Preston writes, "Worsening conditions saw rank-and-file pressure on union officials for militant action, particularly in agriculture, metal industries and construction, all of which were represented by substantial groups within the union movement. In the agrarian south, the number of unemployed was dramatically higher than in industrial areas. The worst hit provinces were Jaén, Badajoz and Cordoba, and where the number of unemployed was 50% above the national average. Once landowners began to ignore social legislation entirely and take reprisals for the discomforts of the previous 2 years, when the PSOE, the Spanish Socialist Party, had been in power, unemployment rose even further. By April 1934, it would reach 703,000. During this period, the weakness of the left is really exposed. The unions, the socialist parties, Francisco Largo Caballero, particularly, who'd been the socialist minister of labour, were unable to mount any significant challenge to mass unemployment or to the power of the landowners. Caballero spoke in broadly revolutionary terms, constantly sort of making speeches to this on this basis, but was not able to really draw up any kind of concrete plan for the overthrow of the government or for ameliorating any of the suffering of the peasantry. Now, what this does is it causes alarm amongst Spain's middle classes. Spain's middle classes become far more inclined to support some anti-communist strongman should they emerge. Shortly after the November election, in December 1933, the Confederación Nacional de Trabajo, or the CNT, the Confederation of Anarchist Labour Unions, called for a nationwide uprising. The Socialist Party, the PSOE, ignored this. They did not want to become associated with it. They thought that this would be a failed endeavour, only likely to bring about the suppression of the Socialist Party if it became involved, and it was not something that would be endorsed by much of the population. During the event, which is a failure, in areas that had a strong tradition of anarchism, such as Catalonia, there were violent strikes, there was some attack on the civil guard. The civil guard were like the auxiliary police, who were a political police force. They were there to support the interests of the landowners, support the interests of the most reactionary elements of the government, and to wage their own kind of war in the countryside against labour organisation amongst the peasants. The insurrectionists were easily crushed in Rioja, Catalonia, Alicante and Galicia, and there were hundreds of prisoners taken. Throughout the country, 125 people were killed. 16 of these were from the police and the civil guard, 65 were anarchists and 44 were just members of the public. On December the 9th, at Bullanz in Cordoba, peasants seized control of the town hall because landowners had been breaking the agreements that they had made about wages and conditions. The civil guard replied by attacking the houses whose doors were not left open. So anyone who'd shut their front door, the civil guards attacked their houses. In 36 hours of fighting, a civil guard, two anarchists, four civilians, including one woman, an 8-year-old child and an elderly landowner were killed. Two of the ringleaders were captured in Pojuna, which was nearby, and shot by the civil guard while trying to escape. 200 prisoners were taken, many of whom were beaten by the civil guard, and the civil governor, Mariano Jiménez Díaz, said essentially that the disturbances were the fault of the landowners for ignoring the work agreements that they had already agreed to, and for amassing firearms, which had led to great suspicion amongst the peasants that they would be used on them. A trade unionist from Baena said, "The same landowners who had spent 400,000 pesetas on a shawl for the statue of the Virgin or on a crucifix for the church, stinted the olive oil for the workers' meals, and would rather pay a lawyer 25,000 pesetas than an extra 25 cents to the day labourers, lest it create a precedent and let the workers get their way. In Baena, there was a master who put cattle in the planted fields rather than pay the agreed wages to the reapers. A priest who had a farm, when the lad came down to get his olive oil, had made dents in the tin jug so it would hold less oil." Much of this seems petty, but it was motivated through politics, not economics. The landowners who didn't want to pay an extra 25 cents were not doing that because they couldn't afford it. They were doing that because they viewed the peasants who worked for them as the enemy. They were viewed them as basically people whom they were fighting an economic war with. The peasants were trying to extract as high a labour price as possible, which would still have been a very low one, from the landowners, and the landowners were trying to extract as much profit as possible from the peasants. And one side would give in and the other side would triumph. And it was a question of who would blink first. So when I often talk about class war, when I talk about Spain in the run-up to the Civil War, and class war it's not sort of idle rhetoric. It's when the people on one side or the other are highly politicised. They understand the kind of the history, the politics, and their own particular role within the struggle against one social class or another, and they in Spain, the landowners, the latifunde, particularly understood that the stakes were extremely high, and charging, managing to screw the workers for a few cents was really part of a wider struggle to show them who was boss, to break their will, to ensure that they did not step out of line, or that they knew that the landowners held over them the ultimate power in a way, which was the power to starve them. Mass unemployment obviously helped the landowners immensely. In any case, in any situation when there's mass unemployment, it shifts power back into the hands of employers, landowners, capitalists, away from workers, because workers are desperate to compete with one another for increasingly lower wages. The same union official in Baena said, of the landowners, they had power, influence and money. We only had 2,000 or 3,000 day labourers behind us, and we constantly had to hold them back, since the desperation of being unable to feed their children turns men into wild animals. We knew that the employers, well protected by the forces of order, were not bothered if there were victims, because they just bribed the officials to change the paperwork and make black white. In fact, they were happy to see violence, because it was a welcome warning to any rebels of the danger of leaving the straight and narrow. He added, "The few times that I went with a committee to discuss conditions with employers, the only issue on the table was wages. There was no question of negotiating food or working hours, since everything was considered to be included in the clause, usage and customs of the locality, which simply meant to work until your back broke from sunup to sundown, or for hours expanded by the arse-licking foreman from when you could just about see until it was too dark to see a thing. I remember in one heated discussion, a landowner called me a snotty-nosed kid recently out of the shell, and said that if my father knew how stupid I was, he would throw down fodder for me. As I exhausted my patience, and I got up and said to him as seriously as I could, 'It is true, Signor, that on many occasions I've had to eat, not cattle feed, but the remnants of fried bread that you throw down for your dogs, a very Christian deed in a town where the workers' children are dying of hunger.'" The new Cedar-led government removed the control on prices for bread and for other staples. So that meant that prices for bread rose between 25% and 70%. Again, this is a weapon against the poorest in society in order to control them through hunger and work. The frequent sight in the streets of Spanish cities of starving people, particularly women and children, became a regular occurrence throughout the decade. At the end of 1933, the socialist parties faced a rising tide of mass militancy that they themselves had not been able to adequately direct, so that they were not at the front of the movement. They were slightly fearful of capturing this energy. And this leads to a polarisation on the left, as members of the trade union movement, of socialist youth groups, and of those who were affected by poverty the most, began to abandon the idea that social democracy, the kind of moderate political centre-left, would be able to provide basic social reform. It had managed to do it for 2 years, from 1931 to 1933, and within months of November 1933, this was being swept away by the new Cedar-led radical right government. So even if Spanish democracy could bring about social reform, it couldn't hang on to it. So this meant that key figures on the left, again like Caballero, had to shift far further towards Marxist-Leninist revolutionary rhetoric in order to hold on to a kind of a caucus of left voters that were moving further leftwards. And the tone and language he had to use had to present his programme as being entirely revolutionary, and that it was designed to, as he put it, disarm the forces of capitalism. He said, power cannot be taken from the hands of the bourgeoisie simply by cheering for socialism. And this would mean destroying the civil guard, the police and the courts, and even democratically reforming the army. So this is what puts, eventually, when the left returned to power in Spain in 1936, this is what places them firmly in the crosshairs of Spain's generals, who believe that there can be no compromise with socialist parties or a socialist popular front. Okay, so that's a little rundown of the social tensions in Spain and political tensions in Spain that become ever more violent in 1933 with the victory of a new conservative right government. Anyway, I hope you found that useful, and obviously we'll keep referring to Spain over the next few months, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thank you.